You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, normally whenever we do a new book, it's important for us to do a little brief introduction. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we want to introduce who wrote the book, why the author wrote it, and around when he wrote it. So, the Gospel of John. Who wrote this gospel? The early testimony about this book outside of the Bible is actually that the Apostle John, one of the 12, was the one who authored the Gospel of John. And aside from that, one of the interesting things that you'll note if you study the Gospel of John is that the author names all of the other apostles except for John. And this was common because most of the time, the writers of the gospel would not mention their own name. And based on that, we can infer that the Gospel of John was written by the Apostle John himself. Secondly, when was it written? This is a big question because I know that there was a time when many people believed that the Gospel of John was written hundreds of years after when John supposedly had written his book. In the 1800s and 1900s, people were saying that the Gospel of John was probably written by his disciples in the 200s or 300s AD. And so there was this thought that John's disciples, as they reflected on the theology in the Bible, started to come up with new concepts like that Jesus was actually God. And so what you have in the Gospel of John is some advanced theology from his disciples. But archaeology has demonstrated that this view must be wrong because we discovered what's called the John Rylands fragment, which dates to about AD 125 that was found in Egypt. And what's written here are just a few lines from John 18. And so this was likely a copy of the Gospel of John, but it authenticates the Gospel of John as actually being written in the time frame when he was supposedly writing. And so if this was a copy, then we can infer that John probably wrote this some years earlier, and most Gospel scholars believe that John was writing around 80 or 90 AD. So again, there are a lot of critics out there questioning the Bible, who are skeptical of the Bible, and we see that there's evidence to believe that the Bible is actually a historical document, but also that it was written around the time when it was supposedly put out. So why did John write this? When you look at the other Gospels like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, sometimes called the Synoptic Gospels, sin meaning of the same kind, and optic meaning of the eye, so of the same eye, that John was probably privy to these other three books and wanted to add his own details and stories that were not actually included in the Synoptic Gospel. So one of the things you'll notice if you study the book of John is that there are unique stories to John not contained in the other Gospels and vice versa. Not to mention, John clearly states the burden behind why he wrote this, aside from the fact that God prompted him to write this. In John 20, at the end of the book, he says, "These things have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So the central purpose behind John writing this letter is so that we as the current readers will look at this and believe in the Son of God. With that, why don't we jump into our passage? We're only going to look at a few verses here, but as you'll find, it's so densely packed with content that we're going to go clause by clause, and you're going to find that John has a lot to say just in a few words. Verses 1 through 3. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Okay, there's a lot to unpack, as you can imagine. The first thing He says that I want you to take note of is that He says, in the beginning was the Word. And the Greek word for this is actually logos. That's where we get the English word logic from. And it means exactly what it sounds like, the reason. And this was significant to the audience that John is speaking to. He intentionally chose a word that contained incredible cultural, religious, and philosophical freight. Something that would impact his readers and resonate with them. So why did John use this word? First of all, the Greek understanding of the logos was something that he was sort of trying to connect with what he's writing. You know, in the Greek world, the logos represented sort of an impersonal, rational principle behind all that existed in the universe. And so, no matter what the philosophy, the logos was the basis, the reason behind everything that they saw. Whether they were Stoics, whether they're Epicureans, which were the two major philosophies in the Greek world, the logos was the fabric that undergirded everything that they taught. And it's interesting because, you know, the logos was this impersonal, rational principle. And so for the Stoics, you know, they just sort of accepted that their lives were fated, that it was deterministic, because they were largely they viewed the world through a materialistic lens. And so for them, they felt like we should just accept that our lives are being determined by the logos. And what they did was they just concentrated on learning and bringing virtue through that in the world. For the Epicureans, they were like, you know what? Our lives are going to end the moment we die. And since we have really nothing left other than this life, we might as well enjoy it. And so they decided that life should be about living for pleasure. Sound familiar? So, you know, when we look at the Greek understanding of the logos, it really represents sort of the reason, the basis behind what is happening in the universe. I don't know if you checked the thermometer recently, but it's been cold out, right? I think 2 days ago, it was in the single digits at night, and with the wind chill, it was like negative 15 degrees. And I don't know if like you're in a house that has like a high efficiency furnace. My house doesn't have that. But we had to supplement the heat in my house with a space heater, right? Now, a space heater has a specific design, right? You don't just pull a space heater out of the box and just fire it up, because that could be dangerous. Usually, it's wise to open up the instruction manual and look at what it says, because there are some precautions that you need to be aware of, such as not putting your space heater within 3 feet of flammable things, right? Like your blanket. You should also put it on a flat surface so that it doesn't tip over while you're sleeping. And so, at best, if you don't follow the directions of your space heater, it's not going to heat your house the way it should. At worst, it's going to burn down your house. And so in the same way, from the Greek understanding, they looked out into the world and they speculated that there must be some sort of logos. There must be some sort of impersonal, rational principle that governs everything that we see. And so John is sort of keying in on this and saying, you know, that logos that you speculate about, let me expand upon that. The other thing that would have resonated with his audience, especially those who are coming from a Jewish background, is his use of the word. And if you're familiar with the Bible, especially the Old Testament, this concept of God's word describes God's self-expression, especially in creation. That God's word actually has power. That it's not just like we're reading ancient wisdom, ancient philosophy, what wise people were speculating about. But that God's word actually has spiritual power. In fact, when you go all the way to the very beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, it begins by saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then he starts going down the line and saying things like, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. Compared to other world religions, especially ancient ones where, you know, there was like pre-existing material and the gods would come together and assemble that and do some sort of construction like you would see humans doing outside. The Bible declares that God is capable of bringing things into existence merely by his word. Something out of nothing as a creative act. But two, his word was his own self-disclosure. God not only exists according to the Bible, but he's interested in communicating with you and me. And that's significant. We're told too that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So here we have sort of a glimpse into this concept that the Word, whatever John is talking about, whoever John is talking about, was with God, which sort of speaks to the fact that the Word was someone personal, was with God. You know, most of John's audience viewed the Logos as an impersonal force. They never had this concept that the Logos was a human being. And so this must have been really surprising to his audience, especially those coming from a Greco-Roman background. You know, when we think about an impersonal force, right, that really has no bearing on your life most of the time. And I think most people, when they think about the concept of God, they're just like, yeah, you know, God probably exists. But what they mean is that God probably exists, but he really or it really has no bearing on my day-to-day life. This God is sort of distant, detached, maybe aloof from what's happening here on earth. And so whether or not God is impersonal or whether or not he does not exist really doesn't matter in principle. You know, when you think about an impersonal force, most of the time we're not thinking about that, right? Like, for example, gravity. You don't think about gravity. You just relate to gravity on a daily basis. Sometimes you're conscious of it. Like, you know, when you're like in the bathroom and you're like on your phone and, you know, you just drop it and it goes into the toilet and you're like, oh my God. Just drop my phone in my toilet, right? Or on the chance occasion that you're, you know, you fall, right? And you're just like, okay, I now am conscious of gravity in a way that I normally am not. And so I remember when, you know, I was younger, I believe that God probably existed, but I thought that he was sort of distant and far off. And it didn't help that I was like part of this church where there was all these rituals and memorized prayers. And you had to go to like this place where it was like this beautiful church and it was like a sacred place that you had to go to. And so it felt like there were all these barriers to actually feeling close to God. And I remember as a really young kid, around like 8 or 9 years old, wondering like, how do we know that what's in the Bible is actually from God when there's so much human tradition and ritual placed on top of it? And so I remember losing my faith. And what was amazing was when I first started to hear that, no, God is personal, that he wants a relationship with you, that you actually can interact with him, not when you go to church, but anytime you want. That was utterly shocking to me. I had never heard anything like that before. And so on the one hand, I was amazed by this. But on the other, it kind of freaked me out. Because if there was a personal God who wanted to be involved in my life, then that also meant that he had the right to interfere with my life and get up in my business, right? Which I didn't really appreciate. And so there are aspects of this that are appealing. Like, you know, God is personal, but at the same time, we worry that now he's involved in the day-to-day aspects of our lives. And it also implies that we need to actually look to him for leadership. Now, the alternative would be a world without God. And a world without God is a world, first of all, without morality. Now, you might say, we have morality. Everybody has some set of moral views. I'm talking about objective morality. What I'm saying is that a world without God is a world without objective morality. You know, most sociologists have identified that most people in our culture hold three views. First, that people have very strong moral feelings against injustice. You sit at your house and you're on your phone or you're on your computer and maybe you scan the news and you start to see all of the injustice, the mistreatment of people who are suffering from poverty throughout the world. And something inside of us tells us that is wrong, right? And so people have a very strong inclination that there is a right and wrong in the world. Secondly, most people in our culture are moral relativists. In other words, when you look at people in different cultures, they have different views about morality than you do. But if you disagree with the things that they are doing, you are incapable of critiquing them because who are you to impose your Western ideals and morality on a different culture, right? And so most people are moral relativists. And to be more specific, when you talk about morality, it tends to be person-specific and culturally relative. Person-specific in the sense that I get to decide as an individual what I think is right and wrong, and you have no right to impose your views of right and wrong on me. In the same way, when we take it out to a larger level of culture, who are we as a culture to judge those of a different culture and say that our culture's set of morals are right and they're wrong? Right? That's cultural imperialism. And so nobody really is in a position to have that moral high ground. Thirdly, people think that morality is self-evident. You know, you walk up to a person today on the street in America. 99% of people that you encounter, if you ask them, do you think racism is wrong? They'd say, absolutely. And you'd be like, well, why? Be like, I mean, it's just obvious, right? I mean, it's obvious that you shouldn't hold a view that other races are inferior to certain races. Now, here's the problem. The problem is when you take all three these together, these views are actually incoherent. They're incoherent. You know, they resonate with us. We sense that they're right, but they're incoherent taken together. Let me give you an example, right? Imagine you walked up to somebody, like you're talking to a friend, and you point out, did you notice that ever since the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021, things have gotten worse for women? For example, women are no longer allowed to actually go to high school. They cannot leave their house unless they have a male escorting them wherever they go. In fact, women are not allowed to work for the government or teach in any sort of secondary or higher education institution. And most people would say, you know, that is wrong. That is wrong. That women are being mistreated that way. And yet, we would have to admit, as moral relativists, that these people, the Taliban, believe that what they're doing is right because they interpret their religious texts in a way that suggests that women should be treated this way. And so it's their strong moral conviction to treat women a certain way. And that leaves us in a position where we can't say anything, right? Where we can't critique that and say, well, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I don't like that. I guess what I'm saying is I feel a sense of revulsion at the way that women are being treated in this culture. And so our language does not support what we actually want to say, which is, that is wrong. That is wrong. It doesn't matter what culture you're part of. It doesn't matter what time frame that you're living in. That is wrong. You shouldn't treat people that way. But we can't do that. Well, the other thing is, a world without God is a world without meaning. You know, most people today find themselves living in what you might call this just feeling of constant vertigo, where we look inward for a sense of meaning. We ask ourselves, do I feel happy right now? And if I do, if I feel like my life is actually meaningful, or I'm accomplishing something that I think is significant, then I feel great. But maybe the next day, I feel differently. And so, day after day, we feel that sense of uncertainty. Does my life matter? Is it meaningful? You know, imagine, you know, we are out in the middle of the universe. Okay, we're going to wax a little philosophical here. I hope you stay with me. Okay, Jean-Paul Sartre, famous French philosopher, once said, no finite point has any meaning unless it has an infinite point of reference. Let me unpack that. Okay, imagine there is a point of origin in the universe, right? And you've got a XY graph here that extends out to infinity. And so let's say you are this blue little dot, right? Based on your relation to the point of origin, you have value, real value. 3, 4, right? So it's your value is connected to the point of origin. And so what Jean-Paul Sartre is actually saying is, when there is no reference point by which we can judge our lives, our actions, and our values, then really our lives are just meaningless. There is no point of reference. And so what happens if we take away the point of origin? You know, we're sitting out there in the middle of the universe and we're like, we think we're valuable. And we think our value is represented with 3, 4. But how can we determine that? I think you can see where I'm going with this, right? What we're saying is this. Is when you look at this point of reference out in the middle of the universe, this is us without God. Without God, there is nothing to anchor our sense of meaning and purpose in life. You know, so many people in our culture today, so many people walking around feel aimless. You know, in their sober moments, in their quiet moments, the thought arises in their mind, does my life actually matter? And that question is so haunting that we will do whatever it takes to try to drown that out through busyness, through activity, through drugs, through alcohol, whatever it takes, never to think about that question, because inevitably that question leads us to feeling confused and wondering whether or not our lives actually matter. And so, what if there is a creator? Then everything changes, doesn't it? If there is a creator, then things like morality are objective. If the creator created us in his image, and he also happens to be a moral being. So now we're not wondering whether or not my beliefs about morality, whether or not that's rooted in some sort of cultural relativism, or if that's sprung up through natural selection, where societies were just merely trying to cooperate with one another and came up with these cultural norms that we now call right and wrong. But instead, we have the language to say, you know what, the injustice that I see across the world, where women are suffering from genital mutilation, or people are being mistreated, those who are impoverished are being oppressed, that is wrong. No matter what culture you come from, that is wrong. And it also means, too, that our lives are infused with meaning. It's infused with meaning because in relationship to our Creator, our lives take on a whole new level of significance. Now, you might say to yourself, that doesn't that sort of diminish you as a person? That your value is connected to the Creator? Well, I don't think so. I mean, when you admire the design of an amazing vehicle, right? You wouldn't say, oh yeah, that vehicle is lesser because it has a creator. Now, John also says the Word was God and he was in the beginning with God. Right away, John establishes that this Word is not only a personal being, but also has the same status as God. And so this is where we get the whole concept of the Trinity, that God is three in person but one in essence. Now, this has confused many philosophers. It has been a point of criticism by other world religions against Christianity. And yet, just because we can't comprehend it doesn't mean that it's incoherent, that it's contradictory to logic. In fact, when you think about the concept of the Trinity, it actually resolves one of the major issues that you find with monotheism. I remember hearing this years ago where somebody pointed out, okay, if God is one and he's self-existent and he's personal, then how could he be relational and satisfied if there was nobody else there to relate to? And so the Trinity solves that conundrum, that problem with monotheism. So, you know, as it still is today, this would have been a huge stumbling block for John's Jewish audience. And so right away, you know, John is like, he's bringing a little bit of heat here, right? I mean, he's bringing some controversy and stirring the pot with his Jewish audience. And then he says, all things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. I don't know. There's not much margin between all and nothing. What he's saying here is that this eternal Word brought everything in existence, everything in the universe. Now, you might say that's an interesting sentiment, but is it actually true? Well, if you look at John's first line in his book, in the beginning, That line was actually repeated in Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning. And so a clause like that, you might just skip over in the Bible. Oh yeah, in the beginning, because we're so familiar with the Bible. But it's actually profound in that it suggests that the universe had a starting point. And people didn't always believe that. People used to believe that the universe was eternal, or that it existed from time immemorial. But in 1929, there was evidence to suggest that the universe actually had a beginning and origin. In 1927, a man who was a Roman Catholic priest and scientist named George Lemaître speculated that the universe was actually expanding outward. And then 2 years later, this man named Edwin Hubble, from which the Hubble Space Station is named, actually found empirical evidence where he was able to see that distant stars were actually moving further away. And what they inferred from this is that at some point in time in the past, about 13.7 billion years ago, there was a mathematical point that contained all the mass and energy in the universe, and there was a huge explosion that brought about the universe in which we live. And prior to that, most philosophers, most astronomers, most physicists thought that the universe was going through sort of this eternal cycle of bouncing in and out, or cyclical sort of thing. So the question is, does the Big Bang threaten naturalism? Here are a number of scientists, astronomers, and physicists who were living around the time and actually studying around the time when the Big Bang was sort of formulating. And here's what they have to say. For example, Arthur Eddington, who was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, he says, "The notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold." Fred Hoyle, who was one of the general editors of Nature magazine, one of the most reputable peer-reviewed science magazines to date, called it a crackpot theory. And John Maddox, who again was a prestigious astrophysicist, said, "Philosophically, this is unacceptable." Alexander Vilenkin, who is an agnostic physicist and cosmologist, says, "It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and proof is what it takes to convince even unreasonable men. With the proof now in place, cosmologists or scientists who study this can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. All the evidence that we have says that the universe had a beginning." And so what we see here is something amazing, spectacular, that this ancient text that so many people have discredited for centuries, science has actually demonstrated that some of the propositions in the Bible, such as in the beginning, God created the universe, that there's actual evidence for that. Quentin Smith, who is an atheistic philosopher, says this: "The most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing." Imagine having a drink at the bar with this guy. You'd be like, "Check, please. Getting out of here," right? And so, here's just to boil down what I'm saying. The universe had a beginning. The universe had a start. And what we're putting forward here is that nothing cannot create something. Something doesn't arise out of nothing, right? Like if you're walking down the street and you see a watch laying on the ground, you're not like, wow, that's amazing that nothing just made this appear. We obviously see the design in the watch. And in the same way, when we see the universe, when we look internally, we see something more than just something that came about through chance. Verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. So John says that there is life and light, which were two Hebrew expressions that were very familiar in the minds of the Jewish people who are listening and reading this. Life speaks to the eternal life that God grants to those who believe in him. And the light represents his self-disclosure, that God wants to reveal himself to you. He says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. So it's not just that the light brings illumination and revelation, but it also exposes us. You know, I got into the habit of buying cheap motels or motel rooms when me and my family are like, you know, traveling 20 hours to drive somewhere. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to spend $80 on a motel because we're only going to be there for like 6 or 7 hours before we get back on the road. And times have changed, though, right? The $80 motel of like 2012 is not the $80 motel of today. I was driving down to Florida or Orlando last year, and we stopped at a motel, an extended stay near Atlanta. And I was walking up the steps, and I saw in one of the windows a katana set that somebody had put in the window. And I'm like, people are living here. This is not good, right? And so when we get into our room, the dogs are barking and stuff like that. And I turn on the light, and there are cockroaches that just scatter. Now, I mean, I grew up in an environment where that wasn't that bad. You know what I mean? It sometimes happens, right? But, I mean, for the sake of my family, I was like, well, maybe I'll pay $20 more, get a $100 motel, right, from now on. But the point is this, is that, you know, when the light comes in, it exposes problems that we have. And so, you know, on the one hand, we like the idea of revelation, but on the other hand, we don't want to be exposed. John says this in John 3, verse 19 through 21. He says, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love the darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be plainly seen that what he has been done through God. And so there's something within human nature that recoils when we encounter God's revelation because it exposes elements of who we are. But God doesn't do that because he wants to hurt us or to embarrass us or shame us. He knows that by shining a light on our problems, that helps us to see that we have a need in our lives. Finally, he says in verses 10 through 13 that he was in the world and the world was made known through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. And so John has identified who the Word is, but now he's talking about how do we relate to this Word. And he said one option is to simply ignore him. Even though God says that the Word has come into the world, we can simply look at that and just say, you know what, I'm not interested. The other option is what he says in verse 12 and 13. But to as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood or the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. He says that we have the right to become children of God. That's an amazing proposition. that the God of the universe wants to have a relationship with you and call you his child. I mean, just to have access to somebody who's rich and famous would be like such a privilege, right? But what about the author of the universe saying, I want a relationship with you. I want to talk to you anytime you want to come to me. You know, if you didn't have an appointment with the President of the United States and you try to walk into the Oval Office, people would stop you, right? If you didn't have an appointment, you try to run into the Oval Office, you might get shot. But if you happen to be the child of the President of the United States, you could come in anytime you want. And so in the same way, God says that because of Jesus, because of the Word that has become flesh, Jesus himself, you have the opportunity to become his child. But he makes it really clear that it's not because of your family descent. It's not by blood. You know, some of us grew up in Christian homes, and so we sort of automatically assume that we're Christians by association with our family. I was talking to my kids. We finished up a book that was outlining some evidence for belief in Christianity. And one of my intentions is with my son, especially who's in middle school, just entering middle school, and my son who's a few years younger, that they have reasons for belief. So we ended the book. And at the end of the book, there was this clear articulation of the good news of Jesus Christ, that Jesus came and died to forgive us. And I said, you know, it's really important that you are able to clearly articulate when and how you placed your faith in Jesus. I was like, let me start. I'll give you mine. 2-minute version. I was 17 years old. I was in jail for aggravated assault. I met this guy who is the chaplain, which was like the pastor of the prison. And he started talking to me about Jesus and giving me evidence for belief. And after the course of months, I started to believe. And he pulled me aside in one of the rooms in our pod and asked me, did you ever place your faith in Jesus? And I said, I had. And he said, we can do that right now. And we prayed. And that moment, I placed my faith in Jesus. I was like, all right, well, what about you? And so my son, who's 12 now, he's like, I'll give my story. He's like, in fifth grade last year, I started to wonder, am I only doing this because my mom and dad are following Jesus? And so I started having questions about my faith. And what I did was I started reading my Bible every single day, which I remember him doing that summer. And he said, I did a little bit of research too, about some of the questions I had. And I said, well, what questions did you have? He's like, well, if Jesus was perfect and Jesus is God, then why is there so many bad things that happen in the world? And I was like, dang. I was like, good question. And he's like, you know, I feel like I got some good answers to that. And so one night I remember just laying there in bed by myself and just turning to God and being like, I want to have a relationship with you through Jesus. Crazy thing is, he had never told me about that until that moment. And I said, here's the thing, though. You know, you remember a time when you were little, when you prayed with mom to, like, receive Christ. But that doesn't invalidate your faith. You know, faith is a dynamic thing. It grows over time. I was like, when me and your mom were dating, I was like, there was this defining moment in our relationship where I told her I loved her. It was extremely awkward. But I knew before I actually told her that I did love her and I treated her that way, but it was important that I expressed that to her. And so in the same way, you know, you had faith in God. I saw that. But it was significant that you told God, I want to have faith in you. Verse 13, he also says, it's not the will of the flesh nor the will of man. It's not based on our good works. It's not because we're good enough, but it's because of what God has done. And what does he specify? He says, as many as received him, even to those who believe in his name, to those he gave the right to become children of God. So if you're new here, and you're not sure what it means to be a Christian, let me boil it down to you in the most basic form. Receiving the forgiveness that Jesus has paid through his death on the cross and placing your faith in him gives you the right to become a child of God. So if you're here tonight and you have never done that before, or maybe you've been investigating Christianity like I was, and you sense that God is saying to you, you know what? Now's the right time to do that. I encourage you tonight to just turn to him in faith and receive the gift that he offers through Jesus. Okay, there you have the prologue of John. Yes, Lord, this passage is just incredibly deep. It's something that each time I look at, I'm in awe of its just how profound it is. And we thank you that even though there's so much depth in what we read tonight, that it's still understandable. That somebody who may not even have any sort of biblical training or who've never even read the Bible before can understand aspects, the basic elements of what you're communicating. So we thank you for that. And I pray especially for those of us, Lord, who have been kind of on this path of trying to learn more about you and maybe are convinced that you are real, that you have spoken. I pray that those individuals and their hearts would just be able to turn to you in faith and receive this incredible gift of salvation that you offer through your son, Jesus. And we thank you for anyone who did that in your son's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.